Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Nitya Subramanian, an editor at the Institute. Sri Lanka held its parliamentary elections in August amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. The Sri Lanka Podujana Perumuna, or the SLPP, led by President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's family, recorded a massive victory with 145 seats, just five short of its two-thirds majority. To learn more about the implications of these elections, we have with us senior journalist and political analyst, Mr. Varuna Karunathilake. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Karunathilake. I'd like to start by asking you about the recently concluded Sri Lankan parliamentary elections, which were held amid the COVID-19 pandemic. It was a resounding victory for the SLPP, which means that the Rajapaksa family seems to have a greater grip on power. What are the implications of this win?
The resounding victory will certainly strengthen the Rajapaksa political dynasty, and especially the hands of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa. Mandate was certainly for the Rajapaksa clan rather than anybody else. However, one should not overplay the result, as it is not unprecedented in this country. Governments have had super majorities in 1952, 1956, 1970, 1977, and as recent as 2010. In the 2010 presidential elections, Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was the then incumbent president and has just defeated the Tamil separatist movement after a 30-year-old bloody war, won a substantial victory, actually 4% more than what President Gotabaya Rajapaksa got in the 2020 election, and similar number of seats in the parliamentary election that followed, actually just one less than the 2020 election. And very quickly, he triggered a number of defections from the opposition, and he had 2/3 majority. So it's nothing new in this country. But however, the important thing is this to remember, that after a resounding victory similar to the one that happened recently, 5 years later, President Rajapaksa lost a presidential election, and then a few months later, parliamentary election, and was almost out of politics. So 2/3 majorities and super majorities don't give you long-term stay in power. The issue is what President Rajapaksa, as in Mahinda Rajapaksa, used his 2010 super majority and convincing victory was to bring in limited amendments to the constitution, which included taking away the two-term limit, since he was on his second term, so that he would contest again. That was the main purpose of that. So he contested in 2015 and lost. But we will have to wait and see how the current mandate that has been won by President Gotabaya, his younger brother, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, will be different from that mandate and that what happened at that time.
So talking about the constitutional amendment, now what are your views on the 19th amendment of the constitution? Does Sri Lanka need to change it? And what would be the changes in the SLPP's constitutional amendment?
The 19th amendment, there's a history behind the 19th amendment, which I would like to touch briefly on. Like many countries that was under British rule, we got our independence in 1948. We followed the British parliamentary democratic model, which is the prime minister, executive leader of the prime minister, first past the post electoral system. That was so till 1978, after a massive victory again, perhaps the biggest electoral victory so far in this country. Then Prime Minister J.R. Jayawardenan introduced a constitutional reform which dramatically changed our political structure, because he brought in amendments, a system which was a hybrid of the U.S. and French constitution. It concentrated power massively in an executive presidency, as in France and in USA, without any of the check and balances in the French and the U.S. constitution. The opposition to this change of system grew almost immediately after it was introduced. However, it took till 1999, every political party, including the party that brought in that those amendments in 1978, after that promised to reform the system where the executive president, an individual, does not have this huge concentration of power. So everybody promised that, but it took till 1999 to bring in the 17th Amendment, which was passed unanimously in Parliament, to curtail some of the powers of the executive presidency. However, after getting a massive mandate in 2010, President Rajapaksa pushed back those limited reforms and went back to the 1978 powers. So the 19th Amendment was an attempt to curtail the executive powers of the president to a much greater extent than ever tried before. It had its critics, which included that it was some of the provisions were individually aimed to curtail the ambitions of the Rajapaksa clan. And I think that's a fair criticism. But however, overall, what it did was take the centralized powers of the president and divide it among the president, parliament, which got most of the powers, and speaker of parliament. That also, for the first time, brought in civil society leaders into the governance structure. So that was in 2015. Now, whether people like it or not, one of the key slogans or campaign targets of the 2020 general election was by the ruling party of the President Rajapaksa, was asking the vote electorate for a mandate for a 2/3 majority to abolish the 19th Amendment, saying what it did was to create mismatch and that there was no clear leader in the country, and that created a lot of confusion, inefficiency, and so on and so forth. They got that mandate. So already they have come up with what is now the 20th Amendment to the Constitution, which not only abolished the 19th Amendment and the dispensing of the powers of the president among the parliament and speaker of parliament and so on, it reintroduced to concentrate powers with the executive president to an extent going greater than in 1978. So what you will get is that if parliament passes these amendments proposed by President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, approved by the cabinet, and is approved by parliament by 2/3, he will be the most powerful leader this country has seen since independence in 1948.
Wow, that would be something. So moving on, what is the impact of these elections on the minorities, including the Tamils?
Now, the victory of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, let's go back a little back. The defeat of President Mahinda Rajapaksa in his attempt to win a third term was mostly, the reason was that the minorities, whether it's Muslims, Tamils, Christians, so and so forth, voted almost unanimously against President Mahinda Rajapaksa. Now, in the presidential election of November 2019, President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who is the former defense secretary of this country, and credited along with his older brother Mahinda, and of course the then army commander General Fonseca, for defeating the Tamil separatist movement, which was a violent war for 30 years, campaigned entirely as a Sinhala Buddhist leader. So, for the first time in this country, since the presidential system was introduced in 1978, we have a president who was elected entirely by the majority Sinhala Buddhists. Sinhala Buddhists are about 74% of the population. This had never happened before. And in fact, it was thought that it can never be done. But it was done. So he was backed by a very, very strong Sinhala Buddhist nationalist forces, including a majority of the Buddhist clergy. Now, the general election of August 2020 was exactly the same. However, they actually got more minority votes than they got in the presidential, but not by much. So, there won't be any surprises here if the government will first and foremost take care of their voters, and that is the Sinhala Buddhists. However, the slogan is one country, one law, basically promising the minorities that they will be treated as equal. This has a bit of history as well. What happened was in the 1978 constitutional change, we also changed the electoral system from the first past the post system to a proportional representation system that gave minority supported parties much more greater power in forming a government than the number of votes or the votes they got or the seats they got in parliament. It was almost, especially after 1994, it was almost impossible to form a government without these small but powerful, in that sense, minority parties being supporting you. Over the years, they also overplayed their hand in a sense, and there was a sort of a backlash against these minority parties dictating terms as what people saw was unfairly. So that was the result of the victory of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, was mainly because of that. He won by getting a vast majority of the Sinhala Buddhist votes, and then he will govern as a Sinhala Buddhist leader. Yeah, so the minorities will have to adjust, rethink, and reposition themselves very quickly.
Now, moving on to the economic situation, how do you think the SLPP win will affect the economic situation of Sri Lanka? Will President Gotabaya be able to implement his ambitious economic plans? And how would the impact of COVID-19 be affect on his policies?
The economy is the Achilles heel of this government. Despite winning a supermajority, which gives it stability, the COVID-19 has had a devastating effect on the already troubled Sri Lankan economy. The COVID-19 has affected economies across the world as much as us. But we were already having serious economic issues when COVID-19 hit us. Excessive commercial borrowings by President Mahinda Rajapaksa in 2009 after winning the war has, by 2014, and we were in a serious debt crisis, foreign exchange crisis, where we were struggling to pay our loans in terms of interest and the principal. Yeah. Then the money was borrowed for projects, vanity projects, which had no immediate or medium-term return on investment, like the Hambantota port and the international airport in the same area, and so on and so forth. There were many, many, many projects that have no commercial value or immediate or midterm return on investment. So we got into a debt crisis way very, very quickly after the war ended. One of the key reasons that the government that succeeded President Mahinda Rajapaksa, the right-wing government, which pro-Western right-wing government, was that they found it very difficult to manage the repayment of debt, and that affected the people very adversely, and one of the reasons they lost the election in 2019 and 2020. While having these repayment issues, we also had a series of bomb attacks on Easter Sunday in 2019, which tripled the tourism industry, which has picked up significantly after the end of the war in 2009, and was making significant contributions to the exchange earnings and creating of employment. The biggest challenge facing President Gotabaya Rajapaksa is how to revive the economy. Immediately, he won't have major political issues in the sense of or challenges, but the economy will be critical. COVID-19 has almost crippled the top three foreign exchange earners of this country. Remittances from foreign employment is the biggest. Then the export of garments. And the third, the tourist industry. All these three sectors have been affected extremely badly by COVID-19. On top of that, we had a three-month complete lockdown from March to July of this year due to the virus. That has fundamentally taken the bottom of the government revenue collection. And we have had to print money like every other country almost, a large amount of money for the government to pay their bills, salaries, etc., etc. So the economic situation was anyway dire. But on top of this, there's another challenge. The ruling party came to the power by creating a very singular Buddhist nationalistic force that is critical for their well-being. That force has a very powerful section which advocates moving away from the liberal open economic policies pursued by successive governments since 1977 and lobbying to introduce inward-looking policies giving prominence to self-sufficiency rather than export-oriented production, privatizing state-owned and run commercial entities that are fundamentally inefficient. They are also derogates or any foreign ownership of Sri Lankan businesses. These are real challenges that this government will have to face, because without foreign investment / foreign involvement, we will find it more and more difficult to A, fare foreign debt, B, create employment, so on and so forth. Another equally influential group is arguing that there is no option but to stick to the liberal economic policies and privatization, so on and so forth, to bring down the debt issue and basically survive in this current situation. However, while this debate is going on, and which is not been settled yet, the government, because of COVID-19, so on and so forth, has had to restrict imports of what is termed non-essential items to preserve foreign exchange reserves. And they are in a major program or campaign to promote the increase of local production, especially of essential foodstuffs, but almost everything else. Easier said than done in an economy which for almost 40 years was export-oriented and with no very little or no protection for local industry. So it's a huge challenge for this government. On top of all this, Sri Lanka has had not have a budget since November 2018 because we had two elections and we were running on current expenditure and you couldn't have a budget. So the first budget for the last 2 years will be introduced November this year. And that would give an indication where the economic policy lies and where we are heading.
My last question to you would be on foreign relations. So how do you think the strengthening of the SLPP will have any bearings on Sri Lanka's foreign relations? How would this impact its relations with the West? And will Sri Lanka be able to maintain equal distance with India and China?
Sri Lanka would love to maintain equal distance with India and China, but it's easier said than done for a variety of reasons. Former President, current Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa's government was seen as very much pro-China. They were more comfortable with China for a simple reason that they had money and the largeness. Plus, there were no strings attached on human rights, so on and so forth. So that was the sort of the thinking that this government would be pro-China. But the truth is not that simple. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who spent more than a decade in the United States, he was a citizen of that country, is more comfortable with the West than his brother, Mahinda. However, our relationship with India and China, more than any other country, is critical for our well-being, and that is understood by everybody. The importance of the two countries can be seen from the fact that the India-China policy has been and is being run from the presidential secretariat since President Gotabaya was elected. He is personally involved in managing it. He recently nominated a close confidant, a former cabinet minister, Milinda Moragoda, as the High Commissioner to India. Moragoda is popular in Delhi and would, to a certain extent, take some of the pressures away from the president and will be tasked with delivering some of the key, I wouldn't use the word demands, but requests that we have agreed to, of which three are very critical. One is the East Terminal in the Colombo Port, a LNG plant in the Colombo Port again, and arrangement which they already own, an oil tank farm in the eastern port city of Trinco. Those are the three projects that needs to be sorted out, and Mr. Moragoda's task will be that. However, it will take a lot of sophistication and sensitivity to balance the competing interests of China and India plus the USA, which is one, if you like, group. As far as the West, as in the European Community and the United States are concerned, despite these two, EU and USA, being the two biggest export markets to our country, they will have much less influence with this government than it had with the previous regime. EU and USA had immense influence with the previous government, which they will not have with this government. EU, for one reason especially, for various domestic compulsions, will continue, probably, if they continue, to make human rights violations during the last phase of the conflict against Tamil separatists in 2008-2009, then you will see serious pushback from this government. With the US, there are two key agreements that the previous government agreed to but could not sign up and deliver, partly because of intense opposition from opposition politicians who are now in power, as well as who actually created a very strong opposition among the people for those two agreements. The two agreements, if you want to be named, is called the Millennium Challenge Cooperation Agreement, which is a $480 million grant for a development-oriented projects, but seen by the opposition at that time and the people because of the campaign as sort of a trick by the Americans to have influence over key land areas of this country. The other is what is called the Status of Forces Agreement, which allows U.S. Military forces extensive freedoms to operate in Sri Lanka when they wish to. Both have been very controversial, but more than that, both have been was intensely opposed by the politicians of the party that is ruling the country today. So to do a turnaround and agree to either of these agreements as it is will be very difficult for this government.
Thank you for your very insightful interview and sharing your insights with us. We look forward to hosting you again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg.